This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call Monday Rethink the Week. When do we tape Monday? We tape it Friday morning. We begin our show every day with some little nugget. It could be anything about what to do with cucumbers. It could be a political limerick. But today I went to John Pavlovitz, who I really admire. He is a very liberal minister. He has a Substack piece that's entitled Waiting to See America's Invisible Men: How the Disappearance of Decent White Male Americans Brought Us Here. And then this was from his Twitter feed. The Proud Boys aren't created in a vacuum. White nationalists don't accrue power in an instant. Racist parties don't form overnight. Sexual predators don't appear suddenly. Mass shooters do not happen in one bad day. Good men also need to be silent. Joining us for our Rethink the Week is our fabulous panel of talkers. We have Stephen Pepere, a professor of public policy at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Let me congratulate you, Mazel Tov. I'm an alumnus of Vermont Law School.
I know you are, Ernie.
I know. He is the
That's
author.
That's the reason I took the job.
I'm sure it was. I mean, I sprinkle my Vermont Law School fairy dust everywhere. He is the author of 4 books, including A People's History of Poverty, and most recently, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide for Affecting Change. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here as ever.
Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He is the author of 8 books, and his writings have appeared at CNN, Reuters, the New York Times, NBC, San Francisco Examiner, and numerous other platforms, including just recently The New Republic. For more of Lincoln's work, you can subscribe to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Arnie. And you know, I was moderating a debate last night, and I want to point out that you were one of the few people who can pronounce the word kibitzing correctly. I thought as a New Yorker, I thought everyone just kind of knew this word. So thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's a play. Hey, listen, this is what happens when you grow up in a Jewish Italian neighborhood. I mean, you have no choice. And finally, we have not had a chance to get back with Ryan Melton. Ryan Melton is from Iowa. He currently manages a team of insurance professionals at a Fortune 100 company. He lives in central Iowa. I believe it's Nevada. Am I correct, Ryan? Nevada?
That's correct. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's because Stefan Schmidt lived in Nevada, and I've been to Nevada, which is kind of even more remarkable. He was a Democratic Party candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in Iowa's 4th Congressional District in 2022. He is running again in that same district. Let me welcome Ryan back to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, Stephen, I wasn't going to do this, but because I mentioned Vermont Law School, I have to sort of say this. I think you've heard me tell this story. I was the graduation speaker in 2006 at VLS, at Vermont Law School, which was kind of interesting because technically I was sort of the alumnus graduating speaker, but they couldn't figure what year I had actually graduated because I dropped out 3 times. Just amazing. And here I am being invited back to be the graduation speaker. And I had just returned from Israel. Okay. I had been on an Israeli junket in 2006. And I had so many stories that I wanted to share. And I think you may have heard me tell this story before, but given what's going on with Gaza and Hamas and Israel, it's really important to almost hear this story again. And let me just remind everyone, if I am correct, and I'm sure Lincoln can correct the record for me, but what I think was so shocking was, didn't George Bush insist that there be an election in the Palestinian territories, and they never thought that Hamas would win that election in 2006. And it was because of the Americans' pressure to have an election that unfortunately Hamas got elected, and we haven't had an election in Gaza ever since. Am I correct about that? I'm pretty sure I'm correct.
I worked on that election.
Am I right?
I worked on that election. Basically, you are right. I mean, what the key to understanding is that this was kind of the one vote, one model, one time, one vote, one person, one time model of electoral authoritarianism. Also, right. Hamas won that election, and I was deeply involved. I can't go into it here, because Fatah did not understand the electoral system and were so right. deeply corrupt that they couldn't. So they actually got more votes in many cases, but that is exactly what happened. This election came. Then there was some controversy about whether or not to allow Hamas to participate, which
exactly.
But this election came really from the White House. It was the height of the kind of liberty agenda from George W. Bush. And that's what happened.
And but they were shocked when Hamas won. They were just absolutely shocked. But I want everyone to remember they haven't had an election since.
I was in Gaza a few weeks before that election.
Right. And we haven't had an election since.
I was not shocked. And I was all over the West Bank, and I was not shocked.
Well, I wasn't all over the West Bank, but I had just come. Kadima had won in the Knesset, and Hamas had won. So I was there to watch this, you guys. And let me just share really quickly the story, because in so many ways, I feel it's so prescient for the moment that we're in right now. So I come back to give the graduation speech, And one of the things that I learned when I was in Israel was the first thing we did was we went to a number of sort of military encampments along the fence and the wall. And what you did is when you walked in, you saw this big, huge map on the wall, and there was a bunch of guys from the Israeli military, and they were showing us where the map, on the map, where the wall and the fence was going to go or is already in existence. And I noticed that on many occasions, it would actually go into Palestinian territory. So it didn't follow the line. It actually encompassed some of the Palestinian territory. And I just sort of noticed that. And I said to one of the military men, I said, I noticed that you're going into Palestinian occupied territory. My question to you is, do you compensate Palestinians for the land you take? And he goes, oh, absolutely, absolutely. We compensate them just the way that we compensated Israeli. Well, then 2 days later, we are actually interviewing some folks from Fatah who had just lost. And one of the things they brought up was this wall and this fence. And they said, and they go into the Palestinian territory and they take our land without compensation. And I said, no, 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 that's not true. I just talked to a military general. He said, no, they compensate us just the way they compensate Palestinians, just the way they compensate Israelis. He said, oh, notice what he said. Just the way they compensate Israelis. What do you think Palestinians don't have that Israelis have? They don't have a deed. They don't have a piece of paper that indicates that they've been living on this land sometimes for hundreds of years. But what the Israelis have is a deed. Therefore, if you don't have a deed, you don't have to be compensated. And I went, oh. And so then fast forward, we're at the Knesset a couple of days later. And once again, we're talking about the wall and the fence. And once again, one of the Israeli leaders brings up the fact that, of course, we compensate them for any land we take. And then I mentioned what had happened with our meeting with Fatah. And he said, well, it's a little more complicated than that. And I said, you know what's really interesting in America? I said, in America, if you don't have a deed, then basically you can't prove ownership, except in one situation. And it's called adverse possession. And if you live on a piece of land openly and conspicuously, you pay taxes on it, you improve it, you tell everyone you own it, and you live there for maybe 12, 15, 17 years, depending on the state, at that point of time, even though you don't have a deed, you now actually own that piece of property. It's called adverse possession. So it's interesting. In America, even though you don't have a piece of paper, we figured out how to get to justice. It appears to me that that's not your goal. And when I brought that up, Stephen Pimper, that was my graduation speech. And what I asked the students that were graduating, I didn't use the term adverse possession. I said, what is that term of ownership called? And then it was like call and response. And all the students went, oh, adverse possession. And I went, exactly, exactly. So that's my justice piece. Anyway, I had to bring it up. So let me start really with what you and Laura Jadid Lincoln Mitchell did, because I think it's really important, because I want people to go to this New Republic article. You and Laura, who's a regular on our show, and you are a regular on our show, wrote a piece together at New Republic. And the piece was how to prepare for a second Trump term. And I think a lot of us are in denial about it. We can't imagine it. Or if we do imagine it, we can't sleep at night, therefore we don't think about it. So I guess really quickly, I would hope that you could sort of set the stage for us. Ryan and Arnie have not read the article, but you and Stephen Pimper both know this article fairly intimately. So just give us a few pointers here as we try to motivate people to show up for the November election, but also sort of lay a foundation for them to understand that if democracy loses, this is what you should envision.
Thank you. And I also want to just be clear, this was a completely shared project with me and Laura. She happens not to be on the show today, but I just want to be clear. I don't want to take credit for any of her excellent work. So we do two things in this article. First, we stress that the threat is real. The one thing we can do, like it or not, to stop it is to reelect Biden. But of course, there's no guarantee that's going to happen. And we point out that the first time Trump was president, there was a certain kind of belief that things would work out. No one could really believe that the threat was as real. And that was a huge advantage for him as he began his project of democratic rollback. Heading into November, I want to point out there is a very good chance that Trump will win this election. And if he does, it is very, very likely he will do it without a majority or even a plurality of the popular vote. So this is an electoral college victory by Trump. And we can't be caught flat-footed again. We can't wake up that Wednesday and say, what do we do now? And what we have to begin doing, and this is what we flesh out in the article, is to begin to build networks between activists, labor unions, clergy, houses of worship, civil society organizations, different groups throughout society to begin a project, beginning with a few very large demonstrations, kind of shows of strength, and then to begin a project, then when certain red lines are crossed, we will do massive actions, massive demonstrations, up to and including civil disobedience and general strikes. And the reason for that is that democracy is at stake here. This is a fascist movement that seeks to roll back and destroy American democracy. We also are clear here. There are some things that Trump will do, that any Republican president will do, that none of us on this panel, and I assume almost none of our listeners, are going to like. So, you know, try to roll back Social Security, tax cuts that shift wealth upwards, which is what Republicans always do, conservative judges to the federal bench. When that happens, those aren't the same kinds of threats to democracy as some of the red lines we describe. Rounding up migrants, attacks on the media, violent attacks on the media in some cases, similar attacks on activists, extra legal behavior, mobilizing violent thugs of the kind of activity we saw on January 6th, but also in other places. So when those lines are crossed, when it's very clearly about democracy, the massive civil disobedience has to begin to kick in. And we stress, just one last point, we stress that this cannot begin, you know, on January 21st of next year. The infrastructure has to be created now as we begin to build towards what we hope is an election victory for Joe Biden. Nothing would please me more than to take this article seriously, do all this work, and leave the plan on the shelf because we don't get a second Trump term. But we cannot walk around. Here we are, we're recording on the Ides of March. Beware. Yeah. Right. Yeah. We cannot walk around now saying, oh, it's impossible. Biden has to win. We can't plan on this. Or the judiciary will save us, which is what so many otherwise smart people believed last time.
OK, so, Stephen, I have not read what Lincoln and Laura wrote, but I'm not surprised by any of it because to the large extent we've sort of covered it. And there are two things that enter my head, okay? We just interviewed Harold Meyerson this week, and I'm going to also recommend people go to the American Prospect as well as the New Republic. And because one of the things that you hear from Lincoln is how all these groups need to lock arms. Union groups, religious groups, feminist groups, you know, I don't know, whatever it is, we're all in these little silos, but for the one time, the Velcro that needs to hold us together is the threat posed by Donald Trump and this introduction of this, you know, despotic fascist. And what Harold Meyerson wrote is there's actually a little bit of a template for this. And you know what the template is, Stephen? He wrote a piece at the American Prospect that was entitled "Turning the Tables in Minnesota." An enduring union community alliance in the Twin Cities may be a model for progressive victories. And what it does is it talks about all these different groups that got together that were, you know, some of them were unionized, some of them are not, some of them are women's groups, and how they began to work together to affect change. And that when one group, for example, would go on strike, all these other groups that weren't necessarily union groups, but community groups would support the action being taken. And in the end, positive results were happening. Well, this was to provide progressive victories. I think what you're hearing from Lincoln is we need a victory in 2024. And what we see happening and has been happening for a while in the Twin Cities is something that needs to be sort of role modeled around the country. This is really what democracy is about. It's about finding common ground. It's about understanding what we do together. And to a large extent, Donald Trump may be the best thing to reinvigorate democracy because the threat is so real and so acrid that if we don't hang together, we will die separately. And I think that that's what's so important about this article. But it's ironic because this is exactly what was being described by Harold in the American Prospect. And the bookends and the timing of them, I think, are also critical.
So a couple of things, and I also want to commend folks to take a look at Lincoln and Laura's piece, because I think there's an awful lot in there to recommend it. A couple of observations related to it. One is that, and you've heard me, Arnie, make this complaint before, for too many Americans, the sum total of their democratic participation is showing up every 2 or 4 years and casting a ballot and then going back home. And that is not what a healthy, thriving democracy looks like. So not only do I take Lincoln and Laura at their word that we should be doing that kind of coalition building and work in preparation for God forbid, a Trump victory. But we should also be doing that should there be a Biden reelection, right? If we want to,
exactly,
it is insufficient merely not to reelect Donald Trump because the rot and the danger is too deep and too broadly distributed. So we need to be doing that kind of work regardless, as you suggested, Arnie,
yeah,
right? There are all sorts of folks in all sorts of places who are doing bits and pieces of this. If you look at all of the mutual aid organizations that came to being during the pandemic, right, in order to step in where public and private institutions had failed their neighbors in order to make sure people had food, people had access to their medicines, et cetera, et cetera. Something not related, but I also take as an important sign of the work that we could be doing is what in some quarters is called bargaining for the common good.
Yes,
and we saw a lot
line
of this, right, with the teachers' unions, right?
Yep.
Not just bargaining for wages and benefits, but bargaining for improved physical conditions in the schools, improved access to disability or library services for their students, improved access to English language learning programs for people in the community, right? If each of us in the role that we play in our institutions can move beyond merely advocating for ourselves, but to think of how we can use the power that we have on behalf of others, that's the foundation upon which we can build a much sturdier and resilient democracy.
So, Ryan, there's your piece. Bargaining for the common good. That's what you're running on when you're running for Congress. You're bargaining for the common good. You're not bargaining for the Democratic Party against the Republican Party. You are looking at what you are running for in your congressional district, and you are bargaining for the common good. And the common good is, you know, carbon capture. It's about all these things that are going to undermine people's integrity, that's going to undermine their sense of relationship to land and to their community. And to a large extent, that's really, I think, what Stephen is talking about. And again, I want you to read not only what Lincoln and Laura wrote at the New Republic, but read what Harold Meyerson wrote, because it's about pulling and knitting together all these groups that are good for an election in 2024, but they're the way to make sure that what happens in 2024, if successful, doesn't then fall apart the day after, but then actually establishes sort of a new relationship with policy and politics that makes people understand that they ultimately are responsible. And if they stay engaged and don't take their eye off the prize, then guess what? They might ultimately get the policies they want and they need. They just never seem to do that. But I think that really is a roadmap for where we need to go. This is a good exercise for an election, but it's actually the exercise for democracy. Ryan.
Absolutely. So I'm a big believer in relationship building, regardless of political affiliation. So I'm running in Northwest Iowa primarily, which is one of the more conservative parts of the country. A Democrat hasn't won this congressional seat in my lifetime in 40 years. So whether it be, so we just are in the middle of our March text campaign, for example. I get replies from people all the time saying, well, as I give them my stances and they say, well, as long as you're a Republican, I'll vote for you because those sound good to me. Or I door knock and I tell them what I'm all about and they say, well, that's great. What's your party affiliation? Oh, Democrat, I can't vote for you. So initially you're going to see resistance because you have a D next to your name. The challenge is to be persistent.
Exactly.
And, you know, so you can't just give up. And so to the point made earlier that so many Democrats look at their civic obligations as going to the voting booth every 2 to 4 years, the problem with that kind of mindset is it takes a lot of work and persistency and effort to knock down partisan walls that really are paper thin once you start punching. Because there is so much I can find agreement on with Republicans out here in the deepest of red parts of the country, whether it be the eminent domain abuse driven carbon capture pipelines, the attacks we're seeing on public education, the awful water quality we have because of unregulated ag chemical runoff. There's so many things
right, that
we can relationship build around, but we don't have enough Democrats that are willing to be patient, non-judgmental, and not angry about someone's past voting record. But in my part of the country, you have to be as zen-like as possible. And if you keep punching against that wall, you're going to start to break through.
as Zen-like. So Lincoln, as I'm listening to Ryan and Stephen talking and thinking about your piece about sort of how to prepare for this, I ran for Congress, and I remember my first invitation, Lincoln, was to a group in Woodsville, New Hampshire, okay, one of the most conservative towns in the entire state. And who invited me? The name of the group, ready for this? The name of the group was called the Good Old Boys, and they had lunch at the Barge Inn. I mean, this is almost like something you would read in The Onion, okay? It was like, ah! And I remember everyone saying, oh, you can't go. And I said, I have to go. Because ultimately, not only will they be my constituents if I win, but they need to hear from me. And not as you hear Ryan say, oh, she's a D, you know, be threatened by this. And what was the highest compliment I think, Ryan, I've ever gotten was at the end of my talk. And, you know, this is Arnie, you know, this is how I talk all the time. And I started talking about my positions, and I was talking about everything else. One of the guys at the back of the room finally raises his hand. And he goes, I just got to ask you one question, Arnie Arneson. I said, yes, sir. He said, you sure you ain't a Republican? So Lincoln, again, the fear and what you are laying out in your piece is so important, but the potential for us to find a way to coordinate, to find a way for us to make common ground. In the end, being a D or an R doesn't feed you. Being a D and an R doesn't protect you when you're pregnant. Being a D and an R doesn't protect your air that you need to breathe. Being a D and an R, I mean, ultimately, you have to look at those things that make it possible for you and your family and your community to survive. And you can't just look at a letter. You have to look at the policies they believe in and say, does my family survive with this, or do we die with this, Lincoln?
First, I'm glad that when Ryan used the phrase Zen-like, you immediately turned to me and I came to mind. I don't get that too often. So there's a lot of very good points there. One is, and we talked about this either last week or the week before, maybe it's a couple weeks ago now, the need to talk to people. Yeah. You don't win elections and you don't build coalitions by not talking to 40% of the country. And that is not easy. We should recognize that. It is not easy. It is not pleasant. Whether you're a candidate, an activist, just somebody trying to build relationships, right? These are not easy. Sometimes it's not possible, but it's always impossible if you don't try. And that's a message for the activist and as well as the politicians. Second, I think of Pete Buttigieg, who goes on Fox News right now, or Fox. You don't have to love Pete Buttigieg. I think we would all recognize that he's smarter in his sleep than most of these people who are hosting shows on Fox. So he has that advantage, but he's not afraid to do it. And that's good. That's the kind of approach that helps us. But your point about DNR is really important, because right now, these are identities, and identities rather than opinions. And people defend identities more than opinions. They can move their opinions, but I'm a D and I'm not changing. And they shed more heat than light. Telling somebody I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat just gets 40% of people angry. It doesn't explain. And you don't build coalitions that way. You build coalitions by finding common ground. And I'm going to give you an example of somebody with whom I didn't have a lot of common ground, but here he had some wisdom. Ed Koch, the longtime mayor of New York, used to say, and I'm going to use his language, a little antiquated, but forgive me, it's not vulgar or profane, yeah, but he would say, if you agree with me 70% of the time, vote for me. If you agree with me 100% of the time, go have your head examined. And we need to be able to build coalitions and have discourse with people with whom we agree 60, 70% of the time. Right. We're not going to have coalitions with people who think Donald Trump is the savior and is, you know, the going to bring America, make America great again, and they're fully on board with that. But there's a lot of people with whom we can build coalitions, even on our own side, with whom we don't have enough dialogue to really move the ball forward, as Stephen was discussing.
Well, but Stephen, we're going to get to you right after the break. But I keep thinking about what's happening with the war on public education. The war on public education is making sure we don't talk to each other, because the war on public education is providing us with a charter to back out. It's providing us with a voucher to leave. It's providing all this, and it's about resegregating schools, and not just resegregating based on race. Now we're resegregating based on ideology. I mean, that's really what this is coming down to, which is in some ways as terrifying and equally terrifying as what we're doing with the segregation and the race concept. I mean, that's with no oversight. So we're using public dollars to basically divide us. That's what they're doing. They're using this common pot of money that we all contribute because it's our tax dollars. And then they're siphoning out those tax dollars. And what are they doing? They're resegregating us, because what do they fear? They fear school. Why? And it's not just about education. It's about building relationships, because that's what school does. It really does that. It may be the first time you ever, it's the first time you may ever see someone of a different color, of a different race, of a different religion. I was just on the air this morning telling someone that I remember going to public school and we would celebrate everybody's religious holiday at my public school because we wanted to know what the food was. We wanted to know what the culture was. We wanted to know the history. We can't do that. We need to take a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We call it Rethink the Week. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
Are frozen embryos children? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The recent Alabama case involved embryos created in vitro and accidentally destroyed at the fertility clinic where they were being preserved. There, as is typical in vitro fertilization, an egg and a sperm were joined in a lab to create an embryo that can be stored for decades. The adult sued under the state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, and the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that the fact that the embryos had existed only in a lab and had never been implanted in a uterus was irrelevant. They said that the laboratory embryos were children, unborn children, regardless of their, in the court's words, location. The rationale? Life begins at fertilization. Those fertilized eggs in the lab were children, unborn children, in the Chief Justice's words, little people. In response to the in vitro decision, the Alabama legislature passed a law that protects IVF clinics from lawsuits. But the Alabama case and its rationale remain. Under Dobbs, that's the Supreme Court case that reversed Roe v. Wade, women no longer have the right to make their own reproductive choices. That decision is now up to the government. So, what used to be a woman's right to choose is now a matter of legislative roulette. And as the croupier says at the table, round and round she goes. Where she stops, nobody knows. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 19.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and we're welcoming you back to the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call Monday Rethink the Week. We're rejoined by Ryan Melton from Iowa, Lincoln Mitchell from New York, and now Stephen Pimpare, who lives in New York, but will be teaching at Vermont Law School. I want to welcome them all back. So, Stephen, just this morning, now remember, we tape on Friday morning. The story comes down about Fannie Willis. The reason I want to bring it up is that we've been talking about what to anticipate if Trump wins in 2024. We don't need to think about that. We need to think about what happened this morning with Fannie Willis. And it wasn't just that the Fulton County judge said the district attorney could continue to prosecute the 2022 election interference case. She actually has to let the gentleman who was one of her lead counsels, let him go. She had to make that choice. And I'm sure she's going to make the choice because of their romantic relationship, yada, yada, yada. But someone made a point this morning, Stephen, that I thought was relatively shocking, that the judge in this case, Judge Scott McAfee, ruled this, but he had written his piece almost a week before. And do you know why he waited until today to issue his ruling? Because there have been so many threats against him and his family and his children that before issuing this decision, he needed to make sure that they were safe and they had the protections in place. That part of that story this morning is the part that shakes me to the core. Because we keep talking about what will happen, you know, to folks in the media after the 2024 election if Trump gets elected. What happens to, frankly, liberal states, let alone liberal individuals? What happens? And yet what you are already seeing is what is happening is with the judge in this case. Why did he have to wait a week? Because of the threats. Because of the threats. And this we know, this is not a one-off. This is a pattern and practice. But I think this is so terrifying because look at how this is affecting our ability to actually move forward in a judicial manner that's safe and swift. He waited a week because of his concern for his family, Stephen.
If you're following the Florida stolen documents case, there's a motion that the Trump legal team has put forward to require that the identities of the jury pool be released publicly. And it is, you know, hard to say what this judge will do, but for the reasons that you just articulated, that's deeply and profoundly concerning given what political scientists call it stochastic violence. These sort of periodic eruptions of not state sponsored, but certainly a political party encouraged violence. I want to see if I can connect this back to the conversation about education, because, you know, what we see going on, you know, most notoriously in Florida, but in lots and lots of places, the book banning, the attacks on teaching about race, the attacks on teaching about gay, lesbian and trans folks. Is all part of the same project, right? As you identified, it is about resegregating schools and it about a search for moving some of those public dollars off into private hands. But it is also an arm of the white nationalist wing that is trying to do exactly the opposite of what we've been talking here this morning. Instead of creating spaces where people with differences can come together and learn from each other and build the kinds of solidarities that create thriving societies, it is instead to eliminate every one of those opportunities possible, to render it impermissible for me to talk about the history of racism in the United States and the ways in which it is embedded in every institution you can name and how we got there and how we unwind it, right? To make it illegal to teach those things is to erase the past and to make it possible for that white supremacist story, right, of who rightly rules, right, white men, property, straight identified men, right? You take away opportunities to hit back against those narratives. It's really, really important that we preserve those spaces wherever we can. As Ryan and Lincoln have both said, no matter how hard it is sometimes to find common ground among people.
So Ryan, I follow too much of Iowa politics. Maybe it's because now I'm on the radio in Ames, virtually almost every night now. It's because I used to do Iowa Public Radio, but I have a good friend who sent me an article because again, I want to talk about division. Because this is another way of dividing the population at large. We know what's happening with schools. We know what they're doing on with the whole abortion issue. We know what they're doing on issues of climate that you obviously are very concerned about, pitting communities against each other. But this was one story that I think will be surprising because it too is a division. Apparently there's a move afoot with Republican lawmakers to create a specialty plate, Ryan. You may be familiar with this. The "Don't Tread on Me" flag will be shown on the plate. But now, all right, we were not going to get hysterical about the Gadsden flag, but this is a specialty plate. But here's the kicker, and you know this, Ryan, because this is again about division. But what do they want to do with the money that comes from the plate? They want to use the money that people are going to pay extra for the "Don't Tread on Me" license plate. And the bill wants to send the money to organizations affiliated with the National Rifle Association. So to a large extent, Ryan, now you have a plate that doesn't just talk about "Don't Tread on Me," but now it's code. And what is the code? That this money that is being spent on "Don't Tread on Me" is actually going to be going to organizations affiliated with what? The NRA. Oh my God. So now as you're driving down the road, it's not just that you have Iowa plates. What are you also indicating with this plate? And this to me is just another example of massaging the divide.
Absolutely. Well, and here's what's really interesting about the "Don't Tread on Me" piece of this. I talk to a lot of Democrats out here who are rather concerned about government overreach as well. It depends on who's in the positions of power in that government.
Right. Right.
So this idea, and I get this quite a bit as a progressive Democrat on my social media, and I'm sure you can imagine how many lovely folks I get in my replies on my social media posts in Northwest Iowa, but you know, you're all about big government taking over everything. And I say, well, the "Don't Tread Me on Me" in my state are LGBTQ plus kids,
yes,
who can't get the health care they need,
yes. Yes.
Are teachers who can't teach basic facts, are parents who don't have true choice in the classroom. As much as the Republicans like to say they're all about parental choice, that's only for certain parents. So this idea that they're trying to reaffirm that we are the party of freedom. The Republican Party in the state of Iowa is taking away freedoms from an awful lot of people. And I bring this up with people all the time. The "Don't Tread on Me" flag applies much more to those on the left in places like Iowa and Oklahoma and Texas. I don't see a whole lot of Democratic members of Congress or state legislatures trying to take away a bunch of rights from those on the right.
By then suggesting that the "Don't Tread on Me" license plate money should go to the NRA, they've taken it away from the LGBTQ. They've taken away from people who really feel like they're being tread on. Women who seek an abortion. By defining it that way, they have limited the interpretation of that license plate to their ideology. To their ideology, which I just think is just so incredibly, incredibly shocking. And at the same time, and I'm going to leave you, Ryan, but the story is the same in Iowa as it is in Alabama, which is the whole story, Lincoln Mitchell, about IVF. All of a sudden now, after the Dobbs decision, you now realize that the Republicans have caught the bus. Okay. The dog has caught the bus. Why? Because they want to threaten the abortion story, but they didn't really want to win the abortion story. Well, they want it. Okay. And now they're denying women access to abortion. They're denying women access to a lot of maternal health care. They're doing all of this. Well, at the same time, it turns out that because, you know, 51 years ago when Roe v. Wade was passed, we didn't have something called IVF. So it was based on a concept that didn't exist today because technology and healthcare technology has rapidly changed. Well, IVF does what? It requires a petri dish and a sperm and an egg. Well, guess what? They're fertilized. Well, if life begins at conception, that petri dish is a baby. It's a baby. But wait a minute. A lot of rich white people want to have those babies. So suddenly, both in Iowa and in Alabama and a number of states, they're beginning to reconsider this concept of personhood, you know, at conception. And yet, how do they divide between protecting a petri dish more than they're protecting a womb? Oh, my God. Lincoln.
This is such a strange direction that our public policy has taken.
Yes.
And I'm trying to kind of navigate this. The first thing I want to say is that you've seen the "Don't Tread on Me" flag, but every now and then you'll see a sticker or something that says, "Oh, honey, nobody's treading on you." And I think that's really excellent, because the don't tread on me comes from the people who often have the most privilege and are doing the treaders, the treading, sorry. And that really speaks to how the Republican Party at its heart is about white male privileged grievance. But to get to your question, which I will try to answer, you bring up a very important contradiction here, right? There are two bases of the Republican Party. And one of them, they don't, we fetishize the white working class because we don't want to wrestle with how affluent white people continue in huge numbers to support the Republican Party because they like tax breaks and racism. And they want IVF. They're getting married later, for example, right? They're putting off having kids till later, and then they need these medical interventions, to which everyone should have access. That's not the point. But this notion that half the country is outraged by the medical concept of IVF is nonsensical. But I wonder, you know, so many issues in our political life today, particularly on the right, but not only, just become folded into the larger identity issues. So I think a year ago, if you polled most Trump supporters, just for example, and said, what is your position on IVF? A huge majority of them would give some kind of, you know, I don't have a strong opinion, or I don't know, or no answer. Today, they care a lot because, to some extent, the media, their media, their punditry, their political elites have told them to care a lot. For whatever reason, a non-issue has become an issue, right? So much of the specifics around the really vicious, vicious anti-trans politics of the right are similar. Mm-hmm. These are issues that you know, at some point, if you asked 5 years ago, 10 years ago, if someone, does it really matter what bathroom a 10-year-old uses, right? Or a 14-year-old, or, you know, whatever, like nobody would have cared even, right? So this is their politics. And it's not the politics of winning elections, because as you point out, Arnie, this is a losing strategy. It's the politics of getting people angry. This is a movement that feeds on anger and kind of creates an anger energy that sustains itself.
It's it's scary, Stephen, and to a large extent, this is so much about eroding trust. And the reason I even say this is that there was a bill in the New Hampshire legislature that basically it was one vote was what divided the win and the loss. And what it was requiring teachers to share with parents sort of the trusted secrets and stories and concerns of students with the parents, if the parents asked. So and you know what this is about, Stephen, because you've lived in New Hampshire, and this is just so shocking, because you want your students to trust their teachers. You want them to be able to learn. You want them to be able to also disclose, especially when they're coming from maybe a toxic household. And yet this is going to require teachers, it fingers teachers and demands that whatever was said to them in confidence must be disclosed to the parents, even if the teacher kind of knows that this might harm the student and harm the relationship. It's all about eroding trust. That's ultimately what this is about. And I think that's what is so frightening. And it only passed by one vote in the New Hampshire legislature, but it went down right down partisan lines. And I keep thinking, but if a parent had a relationship with a kid, the teacher wouldn't be the only one to know. But the fact that they don't have that relationship, the fact that the kid feels only safe in this setting, is basically to tell children there is no place for them to be safe, Stephen.
It's the old cliche for the Republican Party: life begins at conception and ends at birth. So many of these kinds of bills are couched in language of parental rights. But among other things, what seems missing from that is the rights of that child, right? What are the rights that the child has to confide in a trusted adult when they do not feel, for whatever reason, that it is safe to do so at home? Now, of course, the folks who are advocating for these policies do not, it seems to me, care one whit about the well-being of that child. Exactly. Because they have been identified as an other. They are not people whom the law is bound to protect, right? Nonetheless, they are more than happy to use that power, as Ryan was suggesting, to intervene in some of the most personal decisions that any of us might make. And I mean, I don't even, irony does not quite capture it. The one would think that some folks might collapse from lack of cognitive or from cognitive dissonance. But of course, that would require that you're thinking coherently about all of these policies as a package, not, as Lincoln said, merely as part of your identity. On the very long list of problems with our two-party system is that there are only two teams to root for. And we created a culture in which one must be identified with one or the other. And that makes all of these problems that much worse. Last thing I will say, to go back to the conversation we were having about creating spaces for building that kind of democratic participation, this is much more acute in most places at the national level than it is at the local level, right? So if you would like to become engaged, but do not want, right, sort of that sharp hyper partisanship, right? Look for things that are going on locally in your community, right? What's it, Fiorello LaGuardia, who said that there's no Democratic or Republican way to pave a road, right? Look for opportunities to fight for improving the infrastructure in your school or putting up a stoplight or a sign in a busy intersection where people are damaged, right? Or building bike lanes or whatever, right? Look for something at the hyper local level. That's where you can build community that, should we need it, can be mobilized in the kinds of action that Lincoln and Laura were talking about.
You know, it's interesting, Ryan. I remember going back to the first transgender woman that got elected in Virginia, when she got elected to the Virginia legislature. And it turns out she was a journalist. She had been living in the community forever. She'd been covering all those things, the stoplight, the potholes. And when she ran about those things. And they knew her voice from those things. And they created trust from those things. So whatever her gender was, okay, did not matter. It did not matter if she was male, female, trans, whatever. She had built a relationship of trust. And that is really what gave her the opportunity for the win. They weren't electing a transgender woman. They were electing someone they knew. And what they knew wasn't the gender relationship. It was the knowledge that she cared about their community and she knew their community. And that's why, as I keep thinking, Ryan, about how to run in Iowa, my understanding is, while you have an incredibly outrageous voucher program that the governor has been completely responsible for, she's actually plucked Republicans out of their primary if they didn't support her vouchers. But in the end, I think 62% of Iowans are not happy with the voucher program. They're realizing what it's doing to their communities and their schools, because in rural Iowa, for example, the biggest employer in most communities is the damn public school. And if you're draining money out of that, you're not just hurting public education, you're hurting the employment scenario in schools. Are you able to sort of, again, look at these stories that now have been, you know, create a line of demarcation between Republicans and Democrats, but it's really about whether people have a sense of community after a voucher than before the voucher. And if you are destroying community with a voucher, what's the point?
Well, this comes up all the time. I actually came up just yesterday. There was a teacher in the Grinnell School District here in Iowa, and the Grinnell School Board was grappling with the need to cut $1 million from their budget because our public school has been underfunded for the last 15 years, well under inflation. And the point that I continue to make to bring this home to Republicans is, if you know, as a Republican in small town, red Iowa, you know that if your public school shutters and if consolidation happens, the moment that school leaves your town, your town is going to start to crumble, and they're already crumbling. Yes. And so Republicans realize this, that their home values, their way of life is under threat. Even if they don't have a child or a grandchild or a loved one going to the public school down the street anymore. And I can tell you, you know, my wife and I, we've been looking at houses in the district. And the number one thing we look at is the quality of the public school in that town. Right. Number one thing we look at. Hard to imagine moving to a place if there's no public school at all, not even getting into all the details about, if you have a school consolidation situation, you lose all that extra time with your kid on a school bus every day. And so these kinds of very fundamental things are resonating with Republicans. The final thing I'll say on this, because I know I don't have a whole lot of time, I talk about Kansas a lot. So Kansas, a very red state, had about a decade ago a very conservative governor that's a Kim Reynolds clone, Governor Brownback. Governor Brownback had a super aggressive tax policy, ran that state into the ground, and it got so bad, he was voted out, and we now have a twice elected Democratic governor in a red state. So how they got there was pain. And unfortunately, a lot of Republicans are going to have to feel the pain of their voting decisions before they change their voting decisions.
So, Lincoln, you live in New York City and San Francisco, and so you don't have that rural experience, but I was raising my children in a town of 1,200. My children were both born in a hospital called Cottage Hospital. It was a cottage, okay? But one of the things I think that we need to sort of talk about again with public education, especially in rural America, where there seems to be the great divide between urban and rural America, is that not only are schools essential for that sense of community and that idea of bringing people together, but you know what? If it's the largest employer in the town, that means that the people that are employed at schools probably have health insurance. They probably have a benefit package. They may have, and you know what that means? That means they get to keep the hospitals open, because hospitals can't stay open if the only people that have insurance are people on Medicaid. The only way the hospitals can stay open are if they're uninsured or underinsured, hospitals close. Because they need to make sure that there's a flow of income. So not only are the schools important for the Velcro to hold the community together, the largest employer, the reason why you buy this house, because you want to know about the public schools, it also has a connection to your health care. Because these are people that you may be jealous of their benefits, but those benefits are propping up the small rural hospitals because they are essential to making sure that doctors and nurses get paid. And yet we don't even connect those dots, Lincoln.
I agree with you 100%. I would also put another spin on this coming from a more urban perspective, because as you say, I don't live in Vermont. I'm currently in San Francisco, and I live mostly in New York. Not only do hospitals need to have schools that generate revenue, right, and people who have health care, and there's a synergy there.
Yeah.
I live in a city with I'm currently in a city with the best medical school in the world, basically, and with an extraordinary hospital. A medical hospital, social research hospital, with some very good public schools. But you know what? The teachers, the nurses, the people who clean those buildings, the people who serve the food in those buildings, they need to be able to afford to live in the city where they are working and providing these essential services. These schools, with UCSF, with its fantastic, brilliant research scientists, doesn't function without people who sometimes have to drive an hour and a half, 2 hours to get to work, or spending 50-60% of their paycheck on rent, or who are homeless. So another piece of this is that it's incumbent upon cities to create affordable housing, not endless luxury condos so that people from out of town can speculate and hold them for 10 years and make a profit.
Well, Stephen, the housing issue is so incredibly huge. And we have two choices. We can obviously make sure that everyone's salary increases, or we can make sure that the benefits for survival are there, whether it's $10 a day daycare, whether it's universal health care, think about all the things that
housing,
we can do.
Right.
So all the things we can do, Stephen, that as a political scientist and someone who works with social workers, that there are ways of making a difference in families' lives. It isn't always the paycheck. It could be the child tax credit. But in the end, the quality of life changes dramatically, not just for the family, but for the community.
There are 38 member states of the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. All but one of them has lower poverty rates than we do. Right. This is not rocket surgery, as you might say. There are all sorts of different ways that we can improve well-being, and we've got models for that all across the world and in our own history. Right. These are problems that are absolutely solvable if we do more of that democratic coalition building work that we've been talking about today.
And again, the idea of so many of these things could be universally benefited. Maybe the rich person may not want the $10 a day daycare bill, but knowing that they have an option to get it, well, it's good for you too. I believe in the whole idea of this universal. And in the end, that's why I love Social Security. I want to see Social Security to stop the cap, but I want everyone to benefit from Social Security because we're in this together. And again, the whole concept of Velcro and seeing us as part of a larger community, I think is important. This is the special Monday edition of The Attitude with Artie Artisan and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We call it Rethink the Week. Again, I want to thank Stephen Pimpere, a professor of public policy at Vermont Law School and Graduate School, Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University, and Ryan Melton, who lives in Nevada, Iowa, and is currently a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in Iowa's 4th Congressional District. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. All right, everyone, we will schmooze on Tuesday. Ciao.